this shows plainly how little we had expected, much less prepared for, war in July 1914. Our entire diplomatic machine failed. The menace of war was not seen because the Foreign Office was so hypnotized with its idea of above all, no stories, its belief in peace at any cost, that it had completely eliminated war as a possible instrument of Entente statesmanship from its calculations, and therefore did not rightly estimate the importance of the signs of war. Innumerable are the pieces of evidence that as early as the spring and summer of 1914, when nobody in Germany believed as yet in the Entente attack, war had been prepared for in Russia, France, Belgium, and England. Number 1. As far back as April 1914, the accumulation of gold reserves in the English banks began. On the other hand, Germany, as late as July, was still exporting gold and grain to the Entente countries, among others. Number 2. In April 1914, the German naval attaché in Tokyo, Captain von Nohr, reported that he was greatly struck by the certainty with which everyone there foresaw a war of the Triple Alliance against Germany in the near future. That there was a something in the air, as if, so to speak, people were expressing their condolences over a death sentence not yet pronounced. Number 3. When our troops advanced in 1914, they found, in northern France and along the Belgian frontier, great stores of English soldiers' greatcoats. According to statements by the inhabitants, these were placed there during the last years of peace. Most of the English infantrymen who were made prisoners by us in the summer of 1914 had no greatcoats. When asked why, they answered, quite naively, "We were to find our greatcoats in the stores in the north of France and in Belgium." History can show nothing to compare with the World War of 1914 to 1918. It can also show nothing like the perplexity which has arisen as to the causes leading up to the World War. This is all the more astounding in that the Great War befell a highly cultivated, enlightened, politically trained race of men, and the causes leading up to it were plain to be seen. The general situation of the German Empire in the period before the war had become continually more brilliant, and for that very reason continually more difficult from the point of view of foreign politics. Unprecedented progress in industry, commerce, and world traffic had made Germany prosperous. The curve of our development tended steadily upwards. The combination of this peaceful penetration of a considerable part of the world's markets, to which German diligence and our achievements justly entitled us, was bound to be disagreeable to older nations of the world, particularly to England. This is quite a natural phenomenon, having nothing remarkable about it. Nobody is pleased when a competitor suddenly appears and obliges one to look on while the old customers desert to him. For this reason, I cannot reproach the British Empire because of English ill-humour Germany's progress in the world's markets. Had England been able, by introducing better commercial methods, to overcome or restrict German competition, she would have been quite within her rights in doing so, and no objections could have been made. It simply would have been a case of the better man winning. In the life of nations, nobody can find it objectionable if two nations contend against each other peacefully by the same methods, i.e. peaceful methods. Yet, with all their energy, daring, and organizing ability, each striving to benefit itself. On the other hand, it is quite another matter if one of those nations sees its assets on the world's balance sheet threatened by the industry, achievements, and super business methods of the other. And hence, not being able to apply ability like that of its young competitor, resorts to force, i.e. to methods that are not those of peace, but of war, in order to call a halt upon the other nation in its peaceful campaign of competition, or to annihilate it. We certainly did all that was possible to meet England halfway, but it was useless because the German export figures showed an increase. Naturally, we could not limit our world commerce in order to satisfy England. That would have been asking too much. While on this subject, I wish to call attention to the delusion under which Prince Lichnowsky, the German ambassador to London, was labouring. Soon after he had become ambassador, King George came to the embassy to dinner. The king's example was followed automatically by the best society people in London. The prince and princess were singled out for marked attentions and exceedingly well treated socially. From this, the German ambassador drew the conclusion that our relations with England had improved, until, shortly before the war, Sir Edward Grey coolly informed him that he must draw no political conclusions from social favours and good treatment accorded to him personally. Nothing could give a better insight into the difference between the English and German mentality than this. The German assumed social friendliness to be the expression of political friendliness, since the German is accustomed to express aversion and approval by means of social forms, as well as otherwise. He is very outspoken about what he has on his mind. Our acts were founded upon the clear perception that Germans could reach the important position in the world and obtain the influence in world affairs necessary to her solely by maintaining world peace. This attitude was strengthened, moreover, by personal considerations. Never have I had warlike ambitions. In my youth, my father had given me terrible descriptions of the battlefields of 1870 and 1871, and I felt no inclination to bring such misery on a colossally larger scale upon the German people and the whole of civilized mankind. Old Field Marshal Moltke, whom I respect greatly, had left behind him the prophetic warning: "Woe to him who hurls the firebrand of war upon Europe." And I considered, as a political legacy from the great Chancellor, the fact that Prince Bismarck had said that Germany must never wage a preventative war, that German resistance would be neutralized if she did. Whatever has been said in malevolent circles about the existence of a German party favoring war is a conscious or unconscious untruth. In every land there are elements which, in serious situations, either from honest conviction or less lofty motives, favour the appeal to the sword, but never have such elements influenced the course of German policy. The accusations, especially those which have been made against the general staff to the effect that it worked for war, are pretty untenable. The Prussian general staff served its king and fatherland by hard, faithful work, and maintained Germany's ability to defend herself by labours extending over many years of peace, as was its duty. But it exerted absolutely no political influence whatsoever. Interest in politics, as is well known, was never particularly strong in the Prussian-German army. Looking backwards, one might also say, in fact, that it would have been better for us if those in leading military circles had concerned themselves a bit more with foreign policy. Therefore, how the Peace of Versailles, in view of this perfectly clear state of affairs, could have been founded upon Germany's guilt in having caused the World War would seem an insoluble riddle if it were not possible to trace the tremendous effect of a new war weapon, vis-à-vis the political propaganda of England against Germany, planned on a large scale and applied with audacity and unscrupulousness. I cannot bring myself to dismiss this propaganda by branding it with catchwords, such as a piece of rascality, since it constitutes an achievement, which, in spite of its repugnant nature, cannot be ignored. It did us more harm than the arms in the hands of our opponents. To us Germans, such an instrument of insincerity, distortion, and hypocrisy is not pleasing. It is something that is incompatible with the German character. We try to convince our opponents with the weapon of truth, as well as with other weapons. But war is a cruel thing. And what matters in it is to win, after all. To fire heavy guns at civilized beings is not a pleasant matter, nor to bombard beautiful old towns. Yet this had to be done by both sides in the war. Moreover, we could not have developed a propaganda on a large scale like that of our enemies during the war, for the very reason that they had no foes in their rear, whereas we were surrounded. In addition, most Germans have not the gift to fit a scheme of propaganda to the different nationalities of the nations upon which it is supposed to work. But just as the English were more than our match with that terrible weapon of theirs, the tank, against which we could bring nothing of equal efficiency, so also were they superior to us with their very effective weapon of propaganda. And this weapon still continues its work, and we are compelled still to defend ourselves against it, over and over again. For there can be no doubt that the unjust Peace of Versailles could not have been founded upon Germany's war guilt unless propaganda had previously accomplished its task, and partly with the support of German pacifists instilled into the brains of 100 million human beings the belief in Germany's guilt, so that the unjust Peace of Versailles seemed, to many, justified. I do not care what my foes say about me. I do not recognize them as my judges. When I see how the same people who exaggeratedly spread incense before me in other days are now vilifying me, the most that I can feel is pity. The bitter things that I hear about myself from home disappoint me. God is my witness that I have always wished what was best for my country and my people, and I believed that every German had recognized and appreciated this. I have always tried to keep my political acts, everything that I did as a ruler and a man, in harmony with God's commitments. Much turned out differently from what I desired, but my conscience is clean. The welfare of my people and my empire was the goal of my actions.